Today's podcast is brought to you by an ongoing sponsor now we've been talking about for a couple of months, Four Sigmatic and their mushroom coffees, teas, elixirs. They have a book.
This is stuff that you actually do use every single day.
Mm-hmm. Up to four times a day. I have talked a lot about the mushroom coffees and cordyceps that I'll have in my morning drink, but something that they've come out with that I just started trying that I can't say enough about is the Reishi elixir and hot cocoa that promotes sleep at the end of the night. Like I've kind of struggled with being wired really tight and I have a tough time getting to sleep at night. And I've found that these Reishi drinks are probably the best natural sleep enhancer that I've ever tried. Like just a nice little mellow
snooze. Yeah,
you
said that to me the other day. Like you've been sleeping amazing since you've been drinking this stuff.
Very big fan. Yeah. Yeah. Four Sigmatic, they've been knocking it out of the park. I like everything that they've got. Highly recommend them. And if you go to foursigmatic.com/triathlon Taryn, you can get 15% off anytime. Or if you just go to the website, you can use the coupon code Triathlon Taryn and also get that 15% off. And that is an affiliate link. So it helps us out, but help us help you. Today's guest is Jesse Kropelnicki, who is the head coach and founder of QT2 Systems. Now, we met up with Jesse. Unfortunately, I was riding solo. Just Melissa and I went down to Clearmont, Florida to hang out with him and the QT2 Systems pro triathlon team. Unfortunately, NTK, no triathlon Kim, the regular co-host, was not with us. But we got to hang out and see what Jesse does with his pro triathletes, and he is a really interesting dude. He's coached athletes in the past, such as Kate Snow, who, when she won her first Ironman, that was kind of Jesse's explosion onto the scene as a pro triathlon coach. But he's parlayed that into coaching a huge team right now, consisting of really well-known athletes like Lindsay Corbin, TJ Tolikson, Angela Naith, Jeannie Seymour, who's had an awesome 2017 and beginning of 2018, her man, Justin Metzler. I learned while we were down there that they refer to themselves as hashtag Metzelmore. I think Justin does. I don't know how Jeannie feels about that. But it's been really, really neat getting to see Jesse's approach, because he actually started out not as a kinesiologist or an exercise physiologist. He was actually an engineer, and he approaches everything he does with a really analytical mindset. He first came onto the scene in triathlon by developing the first accurate triathlon time predictor. And apparently back in the day when this came out, people were getting triathlon prediction times to within a minute or 2 minutes. And this was for Ironman. Like here, 13, 15 years later, you can still find it on the QT2 Systems website. And it's so complex that he hasn't touched it. Like 13, however many years later, he's like, I just don't want to touch it. I know it works and I know we can make it slick and fancy, but I'm afraid of the butterfly effect. Like it is so complex that his first thing that he dabbled in triathlon is still out there right now being used. He even did a thesis paper for his level 3 USAT coaching certificate on the effective interpersonal dynamics between coaches and the athletes in a camp environment. I asked him about bike fitting and I said, what do you do for your athletes? Do you do a 3D fit or a retool fit? And he goes, no, Jesse Kropelnicki fit. Nutrition. He advises the athletes on a lot of their nutrition. He has a process flow chart for if this, then that, to make sure that each athlete is getting the best coaching tailored for them, depending on their requirements. Like really, really interesting dude. And beyond all that, he's also an entrepreneur. He's not just the head coach of QT2 Systems. He's parlayed it into Outrival Racing, the Core Diet, the Run Formula. He's recently purchased a bike studio. They've got another nutrition brand that we talk about in this podcast. All in all, very excited to bring you this interview with Jesse and happy to say that I would go so far as to say we became friends over those 4 days while we're in Clearmont. So thank you very much for this interview, Jesse. I hope everyone enjoys it. And if anyone wants to get a little bit of the behind the scenes details, go to our YouTube channel and search for QT2 Systems Triathlon Taryn. And the whole 4 days, we chronologically ordered there for you in a playlist that documented the entire 4 days that we hung out with the gang. Here's Jesse. Mm-hmm.
Jesse Kropelnicki, welcome to the show.
What's up, man? Glad you're here.
Just showed up in Claremont about an hour and a half ago, went for a run. Apparently it's hilly and sandy here. I'm not used to this.
It is weird. People don't believe this is Florida. You would never wait until tomorrow when you see the bike routes. You're going to be surprised at what you find.
I am used to snow and flat for the last 4 months.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was strange out there. Treadmill, slightly different than being out there. So I got to geek out a little bit here because I did a little bit of digging and I understand that you are also a recovering bodybuilder.
Yeah, recovering is a good way to put it.
I wouldn't say that I was a bodybuilder. I wanted to be.
I was a bodybuilding enthusiast.
Okay, same thing.
I never competed, but I sure went at it pretty hard for a good number of years.
How deep into it did you get?
Probably $600 a month supplement bill. At the store where I had a 50% discount because I work there. So do the math on that. And, you know, deeply involved in the nutrition component of it, which is what got me involved in nutrition, which then bled over to triathlon when I got involved in it, you know. But it really, that love for nutrition and passion towards nutrition really started in the bodybuilding days. So.
So like, let's hear some stats. Like, let's hear some lifting stats.
Okay.
I told you.
You're really putting me on the spot.
I told you I'm going to geek out about this. I want to hear some lifting stats.
And just so everyone knows, he did not preface me on what he was going to ask here. If I had known, I would have declined. But now that we're into it, go ahead. I was like 205 and maybe 6%, 5% body fat at the biggest, right? And that was before triathlon days.
And what are you now?
Now, I'm somewhere in between. When back in 2008, when I was more into race and triathlon myself, I was like 158. So I had a huge task for about 10 years to take off muscle, which wasn't easy. It helped a lot. I mean, form fits function, right? So basically just didn't lift at all, took protein down to almost nothing. Each year I'd go on what I would call a muscle stripping program where I would bring protein down as low as possible to like 40 grams, 30 grams a day. And obviously not lift anything and go with a, you know, pretty severe caloric deficit of like 1,000 calories a day.
And just let your body eat muscle?
Yeah, basically for 4 week periods, I would do that and lose about 6 to 7 pounds of muscle a year. It's really hard to lose muscle. People don't realize that.
Really?
It's definitely harder to put it on. You could only put on 1 to 2 pounds in most cases per year, but to take it off is still 6 to 7. It's not like you could lose 30 pounds of muscle.
So, well, yeah, I always say that like you didn't put it on in 2 weeks. So you're not going to lose it in 2 weeks.
Yeah. That was crazy. Right. I mean, I started college at 149. I then ended college at about 205 and then tried to take all the muscle off and then raced at 158. Now I'm a 170, 172-ish, you know.
Oh my That's a lot of weight fluctuation. Yeah. What were you like? Yeah, let's hear the lifting stats.
Oh, do you still remember? Going back to it. I thought I got out of it.
No,
yeah,
not at all.
I remember, of course. Let's see. I got max bench was about 365 and I could rep deadlift 405 for maybe 7 or 8, like something like
from
that.
From the floor?
Yeah.
Any
yeah.
wraps?
Yeah. And for
from
reps.
From the floor with wraps?
With
and
wraps,
a, and
yeah.
a belt?
Yeah. Not a belt. No, I was not never a big belt guy.
No, not a belt guy?
No.
Oh.
No, just good form. And if you can't hold it together, you shouldn't lift it, right? So that was my opinion back then. But
I got hurt once on a deep squat. And it always just scared the hell out of me for like anything lower back. Yeah. So I instantly became a belt guy.
Yeah.
And even now.
Just like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like instantly. Boom.
As hardcore as I always got into things, I was always super patient, you know? So like I would always apply training load really carefully over a long-term period. So, you know, I think a lot of the avoidance of injury and avoidance of using those external tools was just because of patience, which very few people have. You know what I mean?
In so, weightlifting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So why'd you get out of it? Like what finally made you want to move towards endurance? Or was it just moving away in general?
Well, it was more like I was probably more passionate about or interested in endurance sports from the day I was born. I just happened to get into lifting for quite a while during some period. So, you know, prior, if I look back to when I was 10 years old, 11 years old, I was more interested in figuring out cross-country routes around my yard, running. I was a soccer player. I played tennis. So it was more of an endurance sports route. For some reason, when I, towards the end of high school, when I got into college, I just said, I want to start lifting. And then I really got into that. But then I realized that, well, this isn't something I'm going to be doing for the next 20 years. And there's obviously a more interesting, at least in my opinion, and kind of, you know, my belief is that endurance sports presented a great opportunity for age groupers to compete and do all these things. you know, you grow up watching the Hawaii Ironman, and that was something that I said, well, I'd like to do that someday. So that kind of all came full circle. And I said, well, it seems a lot more healthful to pursue this sport. It seems a little bit more balanced from a health standpoint relative to something like bodybuilding or weightlifting. So right then I kind of, there was like maybe 2 years in there where I tried to do both. In the winter, I would bulk up, put on all sorts of weight, lift a ton, and then try to take it all off, race triathlons during the summer, you know, flip-flop back and forth. You could ask Tim later tonight. Tim's one of our guys that's here at the camp. Tim was around right when I was going through that period, so he could tell you some stories.
Oh, man. That would be a hard race to be lugging around 200 pounds of lean muscle.
Yeah, I think the first half Ironman I did, I raced at maybe 190 or 192, something like that. It wasn't very impressive.
That'd be a long
impressive.
Day.
Yeah, exactly.
So how much now do you like eating boiled chicken and oatmeal and broccoli?
It is gone. I just won't do it. Yeah, I used to buy those Tyson frozen bags of chicken breast, the ones you get at BJ's.
Yeah, like 30 of them?
Yeah, and I would eat like four or five a day on a George Foreman grill, right? That was like every day with rice. Yeah, exactly.
You nailed it. Yeah, cook them up like six at a time, and you're good for about a day and a half.
They were cheap. They were
brown
convenient.
Rice. I forgot about brown rice. Yeah, that was the thought back then.
Exactly.
Yeah, and protein powder.
300 plus grams of protein a day, pretty much a standard. Yeah.
So before we get into triathlon, what's your take on bodybuilding nutrition? Because back when I was into it, I was like, this is healthy. This is lean meat. I'm eating healthy, nothing but just nutrients.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, I think I could provide some perspective on that. I mean, to me, you know, the bodybuilder is really interested in body composition. So the focus is body composition. So whether you have certain number of grams of protein, carbohydrate, and fat from chicken breast and rice, they really didn't care whether it came from that or came from fruits and vegetables or anything. So they would go with rice and chicken and say, well, it's all the same because X number of calories, X number of protein. So therefore, I've checked those boxes and I'm good. I'm not necessarily concerned with nutrient density, phytonutrients, immunity, all those different things. I'm sure the game has changed a bit now, but really that's the bodybuilder's primary focus, not necessarily performance in the way that we think about performance in triathlon. It's more about body composition. So they're a little bit more, I think, singular in the focus there.
Looking at the macros as opposed to
the micronutrient. I always talk about three levels, right? There's points. That's for somebody who's, you know, trying to go to their high school reunion and wants to lose 40 pounds of weight in three weeks.
That's calories, your top level.
Right. It's not even calories, right? It's just points. It just doesn't even refer to anything scientific. And then there's calories, right? Which doesn't give any respect to the macronutrients or macronutrient ratios. Then there's the macronutrients. So most bodybuilders are at least there because they understand I need a lot of protein. I shouldn't eat many carbs. I need X number of fat. And then the next level of performance, which is, of course, where we'd like to see higher level athletes at in the sport of triathlon, is an understanding of the micronutrients. So understanding that, you could have X number of points, X number of calories, X number of these three macronutrients. You could do that a lot of different ways. Some of those ways will provide really good micronutrient density and phytonutrients. Others won't, right? For the same amount of protein, carbohydrate, and fat. So
people are going to lynch me if I don't ask you, where do you stand on this is like tippy top of the podcast world battle out there right now? Keto, high fat versus vegan.
Yeah, to me, it shouldn't be a battle at all. I just laugh when I hear this stuff. Yeah.
And prefacing that it's on the overall health standpoint.
Right. You know, when you've been around this stuff as long as I have, you realize that everything comes and goes. And the same things people are talking about now, that everyone's like, whoa, what is this? Keto? I never heard of it. The same things were going on 10 or 12 years ago. It's the same as bike cranks, right? For 3 year periods, you got to go shorter cranks. You got to go shorter cranks. 3 years later, you got to go longer cranks. You got to go longer cranks. So this stuff comes and goes constantly. And the reality is that the stuff that comes and goes is not the stuff to attach yourself to. You need to probably be in the middle somewhere, right? And this is just, it's the same discussion, right? It's the same discussion. Whether you talk about keto versus high fat or high carbohydrate or whatever, the answer is in the middle, right? I mean, there's a reasonable logic that cannot be argued with, not these drastic, radical things that are unsustainable. Proper nutrition is about being 80%, 85% compliant in the real world and being able to do that for 10 or 15 or 20 years, right? That's way more powerful than saying, I'm going to go keto tomorrow and last 3 weeks and then say, hell with that, and go right back to your same old ways, right? So we try to be reasonable, stay in the middle, and make it sustainable.
Well, when it comes right down to it too, I think that vegans and the paleos or the keto, I think they agree on like 80, 90% of it, which is basically like eat lots of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
maybe a little bit skewed less from fruits for the paleo mm-hmm. people, but like it's basically whole foods.
Yep.
And the keto people just, they add a heck of a lot more fat. Yeah,
right.
I mean, that's where it gets very different, but it's like that last 10 to 20%. But otherwise it's like basically just eat healthy.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. You can't argue with that, right? And I think the changes in the macronutrients, fat versus carbohydrate percentages, even if protein remains the same between those two approaches, I think the answer lies in what the objectives of the athlete are. So if you are a bodybuilder and you're not training 30 hours a week doing endurance sports, higher fat, higher protein approach, obviously with carbohydrate in the 30 to 40% range probably makes some sense, right? If you're, you know, one of the athletes that we have here at this camp and you're training 30 hours a week doing endurance sports, carbohydrate's probably going to be 60 to 70% of the caloric intake and, you know, much lower percentage from fat.
Generally, no.
No. So yeah, it's, you know, again, if you need to have sound logic, every case is unique. And, you know, the answer usually falls out of that and what's required. If you understand the logic, right? Nothing radical. That's the main thing.
Yeah. All right. Let's get out of the bodybuilding weeds. What are we doing here at the camp? Like, why Clearmont? Who do you have here? Give us the rundown.
Yeah. You know, this is the camp came out of a few things. We used to run age group camps here in Clearmont. We started about 11 years ago running them down here, mostly because the NTC was here, which is a great facility. A lot of our athletes tend...
National Training Center,
yeah.
And it was built for
National
Olympics?
Training Center.
Olympic training?
I don't know why they built it initially. I mean, it's privately owned. It's not owned or funded by the USOC, as far as I know. I mean, maybe it is partially funded, but it's not owned by them. I think Clearmont just really wanted to create a great national location for high caliber athletes to come and train. And I think that's part of the town's overall plan, to be honest. They're doing a lot of things around town to help dedicate themselves to that a bit. So it's, you know, that was initially why we came down. We had a lot of athletes that were from the Northeast where it was cold in the winter. And we knew we wanted to go to a warm location to provide an outlet for those folks. So we started the age group camps, like I say, about 11 years ago, running them down here, actually right in this hotel that we're in right now. And that was where the location initially started. And then, you know, back 10 or 11 years ago, there was a different model with USA Triathlon in terms of the way they worked with their short course athletes. So they allowed the short course athletes to really choose any local coach that they wanted, and they would back that coach, back the athlete, and they can go ahead and roll forward. Now the model has changed quite a bit where they usually find the talent when the kids are young and give them to specific coaches and squads mm-hmm. around the country that are funded, right? So back then, I was a little bit more involved in short course triathlon. And they came out with this initiative that they would incentivize coaches to start a squad environment where they would do training. So when that came out, I put together a proposal for USA Triathlon, and it included Clearmont, Florida as a location where we'd use a home base to start a squad for short course athletes. And of course, my proposal was partially short course, partially long course. We put together the proposal and chose Clearmont and really backed Clearmont because if you look at average temperatures throughout the year in the winter months, a lot of people go to Tucson, don't get me wrong, but Clearmont on average is generally a warmer location.
Yeah, you don't
from
have
a
those
heat acclimation
like
standpoint.
40 degree
exactly.
mornings.
And I really liked it because the housing here is super cheap for the athletes to utilize. We're 20 minutes from Disney, so you get a flight here at any time, fairly inexpensive. So there's a lot of reasons why Clearmont made a lot of sense. So we put that in a proposal to USA Triathlon. They kind of changed directions after they accepted proposals. And I said, well, hell with it. We're going to go forward with it anyway. Self-funded it, started the pro camp here 6 years ago and run 3 weeks every February, the same 3 weeks in general, every year for the past 6 years.
Who do you have here?
We have a good group. I mean, we don't have all of our pros here. We coach about 30 to 35 pros at any given point. I work directly with 13 of those pros. And then we have two other coaches that manage the other pros. But all the pros, regardless, are welcome to be here. We provide a free of charge to them just as part of our coaching service to them. And we do that as an investment into them. And hopefully that results in better results for them, which ultimately helps us. So that's the investment we make. And the only thing they have to depend on themselves for is their travel here and their housing. And yeah, and that's really it. So this year we have a group of about 15 pros, which is a smaller group than we've had the last couple of years. But as I mentioned to you earlier, I'm actually happy about that. Lowers the stress bar a little bit for me. But yeah, we have some really strong athletes here. I mean, you know, Lindsay Corbin's, the Angela Naiths, the Jeannie Seymour's, Justin Metzler's, you know, Jody Robertson, so on and so forth. Keep going down the list. So
what are you looking to pull out of a camp like this? I mean, mm-hmm. they're coming here to train, but what are you getting from the structure of what you've built here?
Yeah. It's really important part of the process. You know, because we've been doing this for 6 years, we've gotten really comfortable with the format. And I'll just for the sake of a minute, I'll explain the overall format of how this fits into the whole season and what the development kind of cycle looks like. So if I start the season kind of after Kona, because that's usually kind of where things start for most of the athletes are generally in their hometown environment where they have a really strong support system, whether it be family or whatever it is. And then we work with them individually to try to address some of their specific limiters. So quite honestly, I wouldn't want to have them in the squad environment during that period because each one of them has very, very specific needs, whether it's work in the gym or things we're doing with nutrition or sports psychology or, you know, whatever it may be. There's a whole host of things. So we have that opportunity, I'll call it, to work with them individually to try to take care of a lot of that stuff such that when they arrive here 3 weeks later, we could spend 3 weeks together and not have to do totally separate things. By the time they arrive here, they're on a similar playing field for the most part. I mean, we still dictate each day individually for the athlete, but for the most part, the group gets to do good quality work together. They're here, they're solid, they've already got a foundation under them, so on and so forth. So we spend 3 weeks here. It's an opportunity for me to learn. I mean, being a coach is constantly a learning process. You know, I've coached so many athletes over the years at a high level, and they all have their own unique challenges. And that's what makes it fun, though, at the end of the day, right? So it's a huge learning process for me. This is an opportunity for me to see them close up and see the way that they respond mostly emotionally to things and learn about them and learn about maybe what their needs are going to be for the next, you know, call it 3 month period as we go through a race season. So, you know, it kind of addresses and lets me understand the needs for the next 3 months and also the needs while here and trying to address them on a daily basis. And then what we do is all the athletes go ahead and race throughout the summer. A lot of our athletes now live in Boulder, Colorado. I've encouraged that for the athletes that are able to do it, that are, you know, full-time really going for it. And right now we have about 7 athletes in Boulder. So those athletes will be in Boulder, kind of home-based. When possible, they'll try to do some sessions together. Obviously, I'm not there. I'm back in Boston, back at home. But I will try to get out there probably 2 weeks throughout the summer, generally is what I do, like 5 or 6 day couple times, bounce out there, spend some time with them, do some sessions together. And then we do another 2 week camp in the fall, which is really the pre-Kona prep. That camp has moved around over the years. We've had it in Huntsville, Texas. We've had it in New Hampshire back in the early years. And last year we actually came back to Claremont again, which is what we'll probably do again.
That would have to be a pretty similar climate at that time of year to Kona.
Yeah, it's hot, brutal. Sticky. It's hotter and more humid than Kona.
More humid, I can see.
Huntsville was certainly like that. And last year, I was blown away at how rough it was down here. It was like a 3 or 4 day period before the athletes were even reasonably impressed with what they were doing. So yeah, anyhow, so that's the year cycle for our pro squad. It looks something like that. And that's really the model that we've developed that we feel really works well. It's just the right balance of spending time together, not overdoing things, not being in the group atmosphere too much, having the opportunity to work on your own stuff alone without any pressure, you know, so on and so forth. So it's good.
What are you trying to, I guess, have as a stimulus or not a stimulus, the outcome for a camp like this? Like, is it overload the pros to like near the breaking point?
It used to be. So yeah. I've discussed this a bit, and we had our opening talk with the athletes here was a bit about how the camp has changed over the years. 6 years ago, well, this is interesting, right? Each athlete has their own individual needs, but then as a group and as a portfolio, they're like kind of glued together a little bit, right? So as a moving kind of organism, they change too over time, right? So I look at each athlete individually, and then I look at the group. Because the group really does change together. They interact together. They're privy to the different approaches that I take. They're privy to things that go on in my life that may change the way that I treat them and mood or whatever. So it's a really interesting thing to look at. And when I look back 6 years ago, maybe the level of the pros that we had, the nature of the attitude, I think warranted a different approach. So if you look back 6 years ago, the first camp that we had here was brutal. I took an approach that I was not their friend, and this was a hazing opportunity.
Are you serious?
Yeah, because I felt that's what they needed at that time.
Yet,
yeah, it was brutal. Again, you could talk to Tim because he was an athlete at that time, and he was in the camp as an athlete.
Oh.
I was brutal. I didn't interact with the athletes almost at all other than when I saw them for the sessions. It was very hard, very high training mileage. I mean, one session that we did was, I look back on it and I say that was insane. But we did one night I had them.
Do you remember, I got to ask, the one where you said like, that's insane?
Yeah.
What do you remember what that day was?
And I don't suggest, just to be clear, that anyone ever does this, but I sent them, again, the athletes don't know the workout sessions. That's a model we still hold today. They don't know the workout sessions until they're going to start. So we had, I don't remember what we had that day, a swim, a ride. And then I sent them a note at 7 p.m. and said, we're meeting at the Clay Trails, which is a location that we run here about 10 minutes from here at 7:30. And bring enough fuel for 5 hours of running, right? So they, obviously from a mental standpoint, they were, you know, they're thinking, freaking what are we out. Doing? Right. So we went there, we started the session right before sunset, and I had grouped them up strategically with people, because it was also late in camp, so I knew mentally they were starting to get fried and worn down. So I tried to strategically place them with people that they may have conflict with, or when the so-called shit hits the fan, it could get interesting. So the game was, I'd set up a cone a half mile out, and as teams, each one, it was basically like a relay. So each one would run a mile, and then the other one would run a mile, right? And each mile had to get successively faster. So if one teammate laid down a fast one, now he forces his teammate to match that or do better.
So they're trying to just drop it by like a second.
You
got to
be really careful, but it was also a competition because the teams were racing against the other teams. Okay. And it was a double marathon. That's the other piece of it. So each person was going to run 26 miles and one person would run their mile. The other person would be on break during the portion where the other person was running the mile. So this went on for about 4.5 hours. I think we finished at 1 a.m. and it was brutal. It was really, really hard. It was interesting to see the way that people behaved when they were worn down, sleep deprived, and just plain old fatigue. But it was good. Again, you know,
you're a mean man.
I'm not, though. That's not anything I would ever do today, right? It was different. We had a different group, different attitude. Triathlon was in a different place, different level of pro, so on and so forth. So that's why I say it changes. You know, it changes. And, you know, that camp I thought was great. I thought we came out of it. And honestly, that year we produced several Ironman wins from people that no one had ever heard of. You know, it was the right thing at the right time. And that's what coaching is. That's why when people want to know single answers to things, there's no such thing, right? It's everything changes, everything's individual, and there's no one answer to anything. At that time, that was the right thing. And right now it's not. So,
so let's create a little fictional scenario. Let's say all of the pros are leaving at the end of the camp together on the same plane and they're all chatting amongst each other. What do you want them to be talking about and having taken away from the camp?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the goal was really at the beginning, we try to be comprehensive. So obviously there's training sessions, there's sports psychology things we talk about. There's a lot of nutrition stuff that we talk about. Ideally, we want everyone to walk away with something new to focus on throughout the remainder of the year. Each night, we're sending out some sort of mental exercise for the athletes to work on almost every night. We try to do that, whether it be a goals worksheet where we're sending back goals for the season, laying down a foundation, or just a quick read or listen to a podcast or something like that that we think is good from a mental standpoint.
I've got like 39 good ones that you
could
send
you do.
Them.
I bet you do. Most of those each night are focused on the mental side of things. I mean, the longer you do this, the more you realize the primary limiter for most pros is really mental and sports psychology. The physical is the easiest thing I do. If all I had to do was workouts and training peaks to win world championships, we'd have won many of them now. That is a very, very easy thing to do, okay? By far, it's the sports psychology. It's all the intangibles that make it difficult with the pros, right? So anyhow, going back to your question, I'm not trying to avoid it. You know, ideally, we want them obviously to take away something new to focus on throughout the season. If they were talking about it, I guess we would want them to say that they feel like it was physically a little bit underdone, definitely not overdone and totally smashed, and a confidence building. Again, going back to the sports psychology, if there was one thing that I wish they would leave here with was saying that I feel more confident in what I could do with myself as an athlete this year. I think that's for sure. Yeah.
I guess that could be taken, with any athlete thinking to an age grouper that is 1 year into the sport. Having left a camp and feeling like they can go out and
right,
not like they're smashed, because they could go and smash themselves
exactly
anytime. Or you could upload that to Training Peaks at any time, but having them leave, go back home, and feel like they could tear apart the world.
Yeah, and that means a lot of things, right? It's not just because they did a bunch of workouts where they feel confident now. It's because maybe the interactions with me, the other coaches, some of the exercises we do, learning from the others, spending time with the athletes, whatever it is, all that wraps together and hopefully gives them confidence at the end. And that's the most valuable thing that we could take away from camp, I think, would be confidence.
Yeah, that's interesting. Didn't think about it that way from a camp standpoint.
I hadn't thought about it before either, so it was a good question. But as I think about it, that's a clear
really
answer.
Coming out. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Can you talk about, like you mentioned, your approach to training in that answer there? Can you talk about that in terms of like the QT of the QT2?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's simple and complicated at the same time, right? And I had this discussion once already today. The approach that we take, the only thing that's consistent in it is, and what we educate, I mean, we've got a staff of 45 people. We're educating all the time with new training approaches, nutrition approaches, sports psychology, mechanics, whatever it may be. The only thing we're really consistent in is making sure we always identify and know at any given point what the top five limiters are for any one of the athletes that we work with, okay? And hopefully we've now educated and developed tools and resources for almost every limiter that's out there on which direction to go if that limiter exists. And that direction is always going to be different. So it's not, you know, last night I gave a webinar on cadence, for example, on the bike. Mm-hmm. It's not that QT2 says you should always ride low cadence or QT2 says you should always ride high cadence. Nothing's that simple in the sport, right? There's value in both depending on the limiter the athlete has. Maybe you should go this direction or maybe you should go that direction. So that's kind of inherent in our approach. That's at the core what we do. We have a protocol or some process to assess if this limiter exists. And if it does, go this way. If it doesn't, go that way. There's no really one answer to anything. And that is whether it's body composition, sports psychology, whether it's strength limiters, core and stability issues, balance, whatever it may be. So
does this come out of like the QT for anyone that doesn't know, it's quantitative training?
Quantitative triathlon training systems, right?
Quantitative triathlon training systems.
This is a little lesson in history. When we started in 2004, I started quantitative triathlon training systems. That just didn't quite roll off the tongue. I still have the old kits we had. That was like wrapped around the body.
Oh yeah, we were talking about that at TBI. Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it was going all the way around the back.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't quite roll off the tongue. Yeah. So I said, this isn't going to work. Domain name was way too long. So I said, well, what about, you know, QT squared, right? 2T squared. So I said, well, let me see if QT2 systems is available domain name. And it was. So we got that. And then I said, well, hell with it. Let's just name it that. It's a lot easier. So yeah, that's the background.
And was the first thing that you came out with that race predictor?
Yeah, exactly. Triathlon calculator. That was one of the first things. You know, I had been working on developing the training protocols and a lot of the things that now today are the core of what we do back in the late 90s. But the first project under quantitative triathlon training systems was that triathlon calculator. I had a lot more time back then and spent a lot of time behind a computer trying to figure out how to predict real world events in triathlon. So
basically like people punch in. It's like
it's still the same. Out there. It's totally free.
Like 12 years later, you're still.
Yeah. And initially I did it because it was fun for me and it was a good challenge. And I wanted it to be kind of a free business card for people to use. And it's remained the same ever since. We've never changed it. It's still a tool our coaches use on a very regular basis. And it works great. Yeah. You put in a 400-yard swim time. You put in a 20-minute time trial, power if you have it. If you don't have power, you can put in speed. Won't be quite as accurate, but get you close. And a 5K run time. And then you put in your training volume, swim, bike, and run. And then you can predict any distance race that you may be doing.
And you're saying that it's down to like
it's pretty darn good.
Cases,
as long as
right?
There's a couple caveats. Obviously, it's best case scenario. So assumes you are rested, tapered, carb loaded, so on and so forth. Assumes that you don't have fueling or pacing limiters on race day, that you're actually very good with that stuff. If you do that, it's actually very, very accurate for the average person, like very close. So
that's cool. That's really cool.
It's actually complicated. Yeah. It sounds
and
somewhat
still
simple.
It's still on your website, right?
Yeah, it's available on the QT2 website. Right on the top, it says calculators and you could go there. The unique thing about, we have two calculators. We have a run calculator, which is based on the same logic as the triathlon calculator. And the differentiator here is that these calculators, like most of the others that are out there, aren't just based on your speed potential, meaning you're not just putting in a 5K and it rolls out your marathon time. It's also taking your training volume, so it takes into account your durability as an athlete. So even though you may have a 15-minute 5K, if you're only running 10 miles a week, you're not going to be able to run a 2:30 marathon, right?
Yeah, you're gonna
totally
up.
Come apart, right? Yeah. So these calculators take that into perspective and take it into account, which significantly influences the outputs. And with triathlon, it even gets more complex because obviously your bike durability, meaning how many bike miles you're doing, can actually impact, well, it impacts your bike, but it also will impact even more so your run off the bike. So the triathlon calculator is actually more complex in being able to look at all that stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Neat. You mentioned,
did you play with limiter? It?
I haven't yet. All right, you know what? I think I want to say that I've played with something like that years ago. And yeah. Yours is like the only one out there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, since then there's been a few that have come out, but anything that I've seen anyhow has been very, very primitive, you know, not taking into account all these different aspects.
I think I must have.
Yeah.
Because I remember playing with a calculator probably 4 or 5 years ago. I've kind of got out of the wanting to know what my time is going to be.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm on the same side of that curve.
Yeah, it always ends up leading to either disappointment or upset at myself for one reason or another. But yeah, I remember early on that I did one and it was within like a minute or two. So odds are good.
That must have been mine then.
Yeah, exactly.
If you had said 20 minutes off, it was mine.
You've mentioned limiters a couple of times. How do you approach that with, let's say, an amateur, like that's in their first few years of triathlon? Yep.
Yeah, I mean, just some key questions. I mean, the most common limiters for beginners would be body composition, which probably has the biggest influence on outcomes and performance. So if body fat is too high, that's obviously something that can be looked at. Number two, race fueling would be very close second, especially if they're starting to do long course triathlon. If they're doing short course triathlon, it may not be a limiter, but for long course triathlon, it's probably the number one limiter that age groupers have.
Really?
Yeah.
Like Ironman or even half?
Half and full.
Yeah. Even half?
Full. Absolutely.
Oh, 100%. Okay.
Yeah. I would say it's the number one limiter, to be honest, which is crazy to me because that's one thing you have 100% control over.
Yeah.
And here we are buying $10,000 bikes, spending all this money to travel across the world. Even more important, time away from friends and family, training hours and hours a week. And then we just don't fuel correctly on race day and you walk the whole run. Like, come on. I mean, this shouldn't happen, right? That's why I've always been on a nutrition crusade to try to fix that problem in the universe. I mean, that's really where our core diet business came from, is trying to help athletes with that, you know?
Okay, let's go with some other limiters, other common
Other limiters, yeah. So we had body composition.
Yep,
fueling. Stepping up to longer race distances before they have the durability to be able to handle those distances.
Jesse, you are headed down a bad path.
Okay.
I have been publicly lambasted many times for saying exactly what you're saying.
Okay. All right, good. Yeah, that's a good path, then. I'm backing you up.
I know. I've been saying this. And every time I get somebody on the podcast, they say the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And then people comment a lot about, hey, it's mind over matter, Tara. Like, well, no, actually, it's kind of like science.
No, it's pretty, I mean, the best cases are science. It's mind over matter before you get the best case. Once you get the best case, I have never seen an athlete go beyond what I thought they can do based on their performance metrics. The performance metrics you look at always create the best case. There's really not that much magic in all of a sudden pulling out this performance because you just really tried.
Right? Gutted it out.
All those things are important, don't get me wrong. And that's why I say sports psychology is so important, because it's harder than it may seem to even get to what you're capable of. And I think the more advanced you get, the more difficult that becomes.
Mm.
Because there's plenty of pros. I mean, and high-level athletes that are very capable physically of doing amazing things that never do it, that no one ever even knew existed, which is another sad thing, and why I'm so interested in sports psychology and trying to not have that be an issue, right?
What's it like being on the sidelines as a coach?
Oh, it's awful.
When you're, like, if that's what you're thinking, because you're not thinking about the physiology of
really
how they're
not.
Doing. You're thinking about
really not.
What's going on inside their head, because that's what you've been focused on from the sounds of it the entire year.
Pretty much. I mean, it's equal parts exciting and fun as terrifying and miserable. Equal, like dead equal. Yeah, it is. It is. Depending on the race, right? And where the athlete is coming into the race. But the higher pressure races, like the world champs, I mean, you know, you just never know what you're going to get. And you know it's a high stake, right? You know whatever the athlete does at that race in their head is going to define them for the next 1 year period. So that's a lot for you as coach to have to work with or try to work with over the next 1 year period just based on one day. And obviously, we're always trying to take as much pressure off of that one day as possible. And, you know, I had this discussion with one of the athletes the other day. It's like, I think athletes think they need to peak like this for that magical day where it has to all come together.
Like tip of the spear.
And the reality is that if you set it up in your head that it needs to be like this, it's not going to happen. You're going to fall off that peak, right? Yeah. The reality is that we want to get the fitness level and the overall robustness of the training stress the athlete can handle to a point where they just feel like it needs to be like this, because their like this is better than almost everyone's
just
this.
Fit all the time.
Yes, exactly. Well, not fit all the time, but they're just not as sharp physically. They don't need to be, right?
But they could accomplish that exactly. kind of race
still get the outcome.
Multiple times
right.
throughout the year.
Exactly. And if you look at, without saying any names, I mean, if you look at the best people in our sport right now, that's where they're at. They don't need to be like this to win the world champs every time. They just need to be like this, and it's good enough because they're like this is so much better than everyone else's this. So, you know, a lot of the game with the pros is trying to get them from a psychological standpoint, nutrition, restorative technique standpoint, workload standpoint, to get their this to be really, really robust.
Just solid.
And above everyone else's.
As a whole.
Right, exactly.
That kind of reminds me a lot of, I always say that I used to play a made-up sport, curling, mm-hmm. fairly competitively. Sport. Yeah, it was like if in Canada you couldn't play hockey because yeah. you were 5'8" and yeah. chubby, you curled.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. We'll have a talk about that later.
Oh, yeah. I could talk all about that. But like we would often get interviewed and people would say like, oh, you know, are you going to peak for this, mm-hmm. this event? Mm-hmm. And it was like the provincial championships. I'm like, no, like. We're going to play the same.
We're good all the time.
We're going to play this week, right, the same right. way that we played last week. And in the Olympics, the representative of Canada, he got interviewed about a game going up against the other top seeded team. And the interviewer said like, you know, how are you going to approach this game?
Right.
And he said, the same way we do every game. Like
exactly.
there's no surprises mm-hmm. out there. I've played them 15 yeah. times already this year. We're just going to try to play well.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%.
You just have to execute.
You know, there's confidence in repetition. And once you determine what works physically and from a mental standpoint, there's no reason to change that. So over the years, I've really tried to bring down the focus on world champs. Like it needs to be this crazy different day. And you need to do something so magical to make it a reality. If we could just get the confidence, going back to that key term, if we just get the confidence in the athletes where they know that if they operate like they have every day for the past month, it's going to be a good day. And then save the magic for the last 10K. You know what I mean? Mm. Once you've already solidified your position, you generally know how this day is going to go down. Then let's make something magical happen. Then pull the ego out, right?
And then you've got some mental fortitude
exactly.
to do it because you haven't been psyching yourself out for weeks.
Exactly. Because so many athletes build it up so much that the moment, and I've had this happen many times over the years with athletes, again, usually the athletes that are the most physically prepared for the event, and I'm very confident in the physicality of it, they've just set it up in their head that it has to be so pointy that day that the moment something doesn't go in their perception to the way it should be for that outcome to happen, the whole thing is a disaster in their head and it's over and it unravels, right? That's way too fragile of a place to be as an athlete at a race like that. So.
It's funny coming from an ex-bodybuilder because bodybuilders literally do peak for like
yeah, they
2 hours.
Do. Yeah.
Like 2 hours over
but
the course of
the
year.
Most of that peak is purely physical and has yeah. not too much to do with here. So
yeah, not a lot upstairs. Yeah. It's just you look jacked and vascular for 2 hours.
Right. It's not about the performance that requires brain cognition on the day. You know what I mean? Not that it doesn't take some talent to pose properly, but I would argue that triathlon probably requires a little bit more mental fortitude for 10, 12 hours to bring out the physicality. Yeah, so
it doesn't take a lot of mental fortitude to do a quarter turn to the left.
Right, right.
4 times.
You said it, not me.
I can say it being, like I say, a recovering bodybuilder.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a race that you think back to most often that, I don't know, just for one reason or another is stuck with you?
As a coach or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's easy for me. As a coach, the first time you have in my case, a pro win an Ironman, that's something you never forget. And that really plants a seed that makes you want to do more of that, right? Any coach that's worth a grain of salt is insanely competitive, and I'm no different. So as soon as you get a taste of that, you say, I want more of that, right? Which is what keeps me going. I mean, the days are brutal. I mean, it sounds like a trivial job, triathlon coach, but with the pros, the stakes are fairly high and it's a tremendous amount of pressure and stress. And you never have a break. I mean, I go 24/7, 365, you know, no breaks, no nothing, just because I believe that's what it takes, right? If I don't do it, there's another coach who's going to come up and do that. So I've got to work harder and do that. So yeah, so it's tremendously hard, takes a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and that's 99% of the time, but it's all worth it for that 1% of the time when the athlete comes across the finish line first or whatever their first is. It doesn't even necessarily need to be a win, right? Whatever we're trying to accomplish for that season, it all becomes very worth it very quickly. So
who was that first
anyway,
race
so
where
it,
was it?
This was Lake Placid 2008. It was Caitlin Snow. who at the time was basically unknown. No one knew who she was. She had come from a little bit of ITU racing. She was out for a year with a knee injury. And then when she came back, I had met her through Tim, who's here. I had met her and she said, you know, I'd really maybe like to pursue long course and maybe go after Ironman next year. I said, all right, I'll help train you. So we trained for 1 year. And then she showed up at Lake Placid in 2008 as a relative unknown and went and ran 2:56 off the bike and won the race. And it was a blast. Yeah. So, and that's what really started everything for me as a pro coach was really that win because it gives you a lot of credibility. More people were interested, so on and so forth.
Do you remember the first thing that you two said to each other after the finish line?
I don't because I was racing actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was pouring rain that year and Kate won. She was obviously ahead of me. And yeah, and I was on the race course. I think I was still on the race course when she finished, to be honest. And I came across very shortly thereafter. So
did you even know? Like, did you know while you were racing that she had
won? Yeah,
won?
Yeah. I generally knew where she was in the race.
Because you could pass her and see where she
was. Exactly. The way Lake Placid set up. Yeah, there's out and backs and whatnot. So, but yeah, it was a blast. It was. So still, I mean, that's what I live for, right? I live for those moments every year. And we're fortunate enough now to have many of those moments every year, which is great.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty
cool. Very addictive. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Can you talk a little bit about like the scope of everything that you do? Because it's not just, I think a lot of people will hear triathlon coach, you know, somebody creating plans and training peaks and dropping workouts in a dark basement. But you mentioned like you've got 45 employees and what do you have, like 5-6 companies?
Yeah, it's gotten crazy. I won't say out of control because that wouldn't be true, but it's gotten crazy. You know, we started in 2004, 2005. It was just me, just coaching a couple age groupers and started with that. Mind you, I'd been creating a lot of the documentation and protocols from 1997, 1998 timeframe. So I had a lot of that already built and polished, so on and so forth. Kind of got rolling from there, you know, took on a couple other coaches that I can remember training in my living room at the time. We would ride together. They were athletes as well. And then they'd come back to my house and we'd sit at the kitchen table for 6 hours and just, I would just show them philosophy, periodization, what I call histograms, how to manage training stress, nutrition, just week after week after week. And that's really the roots of our coaching curriculum started like that. Just me in the kitchen showing these guys how to do it. And then they took on athletes and we grew very quickly. I mean, we were lucky to start during the triathlon kind of boom that kind of came in those late 2000s timeframe. We kind of grew very, very quickly from 2005 through 2011. By the time 2008 came around, we probably had about 100 athletes that were coaching with maybe 4 or 5 coaches. That was the year Kate won the Ironman, which helped boost things a bit. I then started to work with more pros, which also gained more notoriety and credibility. In about 2010, we split off our nutrition services away from QT2 because we knew that we were the only ones really doing performance nutrition for triathlon for the most part as a group. There was plenty of single dietitians out there doing things, but we had a team of 4 registered dietitians at that time that would work together, again, specific protocols to fueling plans, body composition for endurance athletes only. So we split off the core diet because there was a lot of coaching groups that wanted to utilize our nutrition services, but they didn't want to utilize QT2 because they're worried about us taking athletes as coaching clients. So we split it off totally separate brand called the core diet. And that was the beginning of that kind of making more brands thing. Yeah. So then we had QT2, hardcore triathlon, and the core diet. Then several years later, we realized that QT2 is very, very performance-based. I had an initial thought on what I wanted QT2 to be, and that was quantitative in nature for the most part. Nowadays, that's changed, but let's just say serious athletes that are really looking to the next level of detail to be able to improve. They've already kind of done what they can on their own and want to take it to the next level. And we've stuck to that forever. We've never offered a prepackaged training program. We do not offer them. It could have been a great money-making scheme, but it was against kind of our core philosophy. So I've always been a big believer in sticking to what you really believe in. I mean, it'll pay off in the long run, right? So that was the approach we took with QT2, but we realized that we're missing a large demographic of athletes that can probably benefit from our services, beginners, people that don't want to pay $300-$400 a month for coaching. You know, it's not that there's anything wrong with it. There's just people that don't necessarily need that level of detail, nor do they want to pay for it. So we went and purchased in 2000, and I may get this wrong, 14 or 15 Outrival Racing, which was a coaching group out of the Woodlands, Texas in the Houston area. And they had a lot of athletes that were paying lower price point, more beginner type athletes, kind of everything QT2 wasn't. So we ended up acquiring Outrival Racing. So that spread us out geographically, also brought on a whole nother demographic, group in-person training sessions, youth and junior team. We coach, you know, 20 or 30 youths and juniors right now out of the Woodlands and the Houston area. So, you know, people ask, well, why didn't you just make that called QT2 after you bought it? Because the QT2 brand is not something we wanted to dilute with a different, you know, just one example. Let's say I have an athlete that now we're offering prepackaged training programs through Outrival because it's a beginner athlete. They don't need the high price point. They don't necessarily need the level of detail. If we now offered that through QT2, somebody takes one of these prepackaged training programs for $20. They do it. They don't do it though, really, right? They only do half of it. They get injured. They get all beat up. And their buddy says, oh, you did the QT2 thing. How'd it go? Oh, it was terrible. I was beat up. I was injured. It was awful. And it dilutes the brand and undermines us. So what we've always done is we've kept Outrival separate. So Outrival is lower price points, same philosophy, same back engine, a lot of the same staff, even, you know, everything's generally the same. It's all operated under one business, just different brands. Mm. So that's how Outrival came about. And then since then, for the same reasons, we've added the cycling formula, which is cycling specific. No cyclist would ever go to the triathlon specific QT2 website and want coaching. No. So we need a separate brand for that. And then we have the run formula. And we also own a cycling studio called Cycle Life Studio in Massachusetts. So
you're still fit. How do you get this all in?
I wouldn't get
in
too crazy with that.
Well, I mean, you're not deadlifting 405 lobby, but, yeah. But like, you're still in decent shape. How are you fitting all of this in?
I made a rule. I mean,
and still. Obviously running or cycling.
I have a lot of help. I like to say I'm just the pretty face of the operation. Which
I wish I had that title.
Exactly right. You know, I've got a lot of good help. As I said, you know, we've got 45, actually more than that, with our instructors and whatnot. We've got 65 or 70 people that work for us. We also have quite a few employees, which is rare in this space. So people that are salaried, they have benefits with us. They're really invested in what we do. And that helps a ton, obviously. My passion has always been working with the pros. And when I started, you know, Tim Snow was the first guy that hooked up with me to become a coach. And he's been with me since day one. He's here. You know, he told me early on, and he's stuck to that. He said, you're okay as an athlete, but he said, you have an insane talent as a coach. He said, I'm here to back you up. I'll be the worker. You just tell me what you want done and I'll get it done. You focus on the athletes and the pros and we're going to win a world championship. And he's stuck to that since the beginning. And that's helped tremendously. So it's allowed me, even though we have a fairly large organization to manage, you know, call it 70 people that work for us, 20 of which are employees, they're salaried, rest are contractors, coach 700 athletes. It still allows me to focus my number one priority on the pros that I coach, which is 13 of them. So going back to your initial comment, well, you're a triathlon coach, but you have all this other stuff going on. It presents me a unique opportunity that very few coaches have, because most coaches who are passionate about and interested in working with professionals, they have to still pay their mortgage at the end of the month, right? Mm-hmm. So they end up having to coach a bunch of age groupers at a high price point or some other mix of things to pay the bills. And that at the end of the day takes away their ability to properly serve the pros and get the best they can out of the pros that they work with. So the organization that we have luckily is set up such that paying my mortgage at the end of the month does not depend on what the pros pay. It's just not part of the picture. So it allows me to just focus. I only coach pros and I only coach 13 of them. And that's a standard. And it's been like that for 5 years.
Ooh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
That is. Yeah. It allows you to, like, I'm hearing a lot of like segmenting what you're good at into boxes.
I just realized. You asked how I'm in such phenomenal shape, and I went off tangent.
I don't even remember what it was. You get one chance to dazzle me here. That's it. Well, yeah, like, what's an average day? Let's go through that really quickly.
So in 2012, when things got really busy, we were moving to a new house, I just had kids, I said, I can't do this as an athlete anymore. I have to dedicate 100% to coaching. So that was at that day, that was the last triathlon I did was in 2012. That was basically the end of it. So on June 1st, 2012, I said to myself, I need to make a rule. Otherwise, I'm going to become the fat out of shape coach. I'm really good at sticking to rules if I commit to them, right? So I committed to running a minimum of 20 minutes every single day for basically for good. So that's what I've done. So I've gone whatever it is now, almost 6 years straight without missing a single day of 20
really?
Minutes. Yep. So
do you do that thing on, what is it, on Instagram, hashtag streaking?
No.
No?
I've done two posts on Instagram. The athletes were giving me crap on it the other day. But so no, I definitely do not do that. Yeah. So it's been a good run though. No pun intended.
And like you're putting in what? 8, 10, 12, 14 hour days in work?
No, more than that. Work? Yeah, it's just, it's 16 every day.
A 16 hour day?
Yeah, I don't do anything. Every I don't day? Watch TV. Yeah. But I love it. It's very sustainable.
How do you stay mentally not burned out?
You know, you get a little dull at night before you go to bed sometimes, but I wake up generally pretty refreshed and fired up to take on the day. I mean, to be honest. You know, a tremendous help, obviously. My wife is insanely supportive. She's like one of a kind to put up with a person like me. I like to think that's why she picked me in the first place. But yeah, without her, it would be impossible also. So she understands how much it means to me to work with the pros that I work with and how much work it is to do it. So, you know, I left her at home with a 5 and 7 year old to come down to sunny Florida for 3 weeks. You know, there's very few people who would make that sacrifice. So that helps a ton. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Last question here. When was your first race? I should know this.
First triathlon?
Yeah.
97.
97?
Yep. I raced a sprint triathlon in Harriman State Park in New York, which is where I grew up in 1997. Yep.
Can you think back to say what happened in those first few races? Lessons that you learned, and like triathlon changes everyone, and you wouldn't still be in the sport if it didn't change you in those first couple of years.
Yeah.
What was it about triathlon that changed you then that has allowed you to have this 70 person company, coach 13 pros, multiple Ironman wins, all the accomplishments that you had? Like, what can you pinpoint back to that first few races?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm a firm believer. Passion is like an insanely powerful word. And a lot of people, I think, in triathlon get that bug, right? They do their first triathlon, they immediately have a passion for it. And I'm, you know, anything that I've ever done, I get ridiculous, probably overly passionate about it and then just dedicate to it. I'm not one of these people who switched college majors, right? Because I made a decision when I was in whatever high school that I wanted to be an engineer. And that was the path that I took. I never took a single class that wasn't useful. You know what I mean? So I was like that. I did my first triathlon. I said, this is awesome. There's a lot of pieces to this. There's mechanics, there's psychology, there's swim, there's bike, there's run, there's nutrition. I like the complexity of this. And I've always had a passion, if I really stripped it down to something raw, I've always had a passion for trying to predict real world events with science. You know what I mean? Even when I was an engineer, that was what I liked to do. I like to try to predict the way a structure would behave in the real world. And this is very similar. So I think the complexity of triathlon after my first triathlon got me excited and passionate about it and then just dedicated to it. Yeah.
I like that. That's a fantastic place to end it, I think. Yeah. Where should people check you out? Obviously not Instagram, apparently.
Yeah, definitely not Instagram. Yeah, just go to the websites. I mean, the QT2 website, qt2systems.com, is a good place to start. Another brand that I'm involved in is called Fieldwork Nutrition. We have a Primo smoothie. We're partnered with someone else on that. It's a great product, though, for endurance athletes. You know, the core diet, if you're interested in nutrition services.
The cookbook is Endurance Training Diet and Cookbook.
And cookbook, yep. That was published last year by Random House. It's on Amazon. You can find that just about anywhere. Yeah, and then Outrival Racing. Obviously, if you're a beginner triathlete, that's a great place to check some things out. A lot of free resources. Check out Triathlon Calculator. You know, plenty of places.
Yeah. Find out what your finish time is going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Thanks for spending the time here. This is a lot of fun.
No, I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Everything will be linked up in the show notes, so people should go check out Jesse. And yeah, it'll be fun to watch you apparently not smash the crew over the next few days.
Well, we'll see about that.
Just a little bit of smashing.
Yeah, a little bit of smashing. Yeah. Healthy smashing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. Cool. Thanks.
If there was anything on the podcast that you heard and you want to know more about, you can visit our show notes at triathlonterran.com/topics/triathlonterranpodcast. We'll have all of the links listed there. Any other info that you may not have had time to write down or whatever, it's listed there for you in perpetuity.
Something newer, juicier, freer.
We love free.
We've had resources kind of scattered throughout the website for the past year that we've built up. Well, I have put that all on one single page on the website at triathlonterran.com/free resources. Just by entering your email address, you can get a free swim drill program, a free strength training program, a running drill program. And as we start coming out with things, everything will be there. So you can check it now, you can check it later.
Come early, come often. Mm-hmm. We'll be adding stuff all the time, so make sure you check it out frequently. Also, if you've got questions for Taryn, and many of you do, and you leave them in the YouTube comments, Facebook, Instagram, etc., we're trying to aggregate that all into one spot so everybody can see and hear the answer. And that's why we've now launched the Triathlon Trainiask podcast, because it's Trainiacs asking questions. So what we want you to do is head over to triathlontaryn.com/trainiask. If you have a question, you'll record it and Taryn may answer it on the podcast. He's recording them every single weekday, and you can find the podcast on every single podcast player out there. And Trainiask is spelled T-R-A-I-N-I-A-S-K.
Short nuggets of info. Every right. episode, I guarantee under 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And it's hard to get me to stop talking. So this is a feat. Finally, last thing that you can do is if you like this show or the Trainiask show when you check it out, head over to iTunes, give us a review, good, bad, indifferent. Hopefully 5 stars because we're pretty awesome.
Reviews just really help us out.
It really helps with the iTunes algorithm. However it happens, it works. It's internet magic and helps other new or aspiring Trainiacs discover us. So that would be much appreciated.
Thanks, folks. See you next time.